We're going to talk about some things that might be posing a risk to your organization, underreported crypto theft vulnerabilities that you should be concerned about, 91 ransomware attacks, 1 billion person data breach.
Welcome to the State of Cybercrime podcast. I'm your host, Matt Radilak from Varonis. The following podcast has been adapted from a live show. Check out our YouTube channel for the full video and sign up on our website to be notified of upcoming live events.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of State of Cybercrime. I'm joined today by our usual co-host, David Gibson, who's back from vacation. I know many of you missed him in our last episode. We've also got a special guest today, which is Trevor Brenn. If you want to say hello, Trevor. Trevor joins us from Varonis's federal data security engineering team to talk specifically about the DoD's response to the data leaks. Really excited to have you back, David, and have you here today, Trevor.
Yeah, Matt, thanks for having me on.
Good to be back.
We are going to crack right into it today. We want to actually start today really by talking about the call from DoD to take action in response to the Pentagon Discord leaks. And we'll remind you guys a little bit about that. And then we'll go through our usual segments. As always, we want to talk about some good news in cyber. We'll jump on into the danger zone and talk about some of the threat actors that you guys should be worried about. We'll round it out with some vulnerabilities, including one in a UDP protocol that Mr. Gibson is extremely passionate about. And we always save time at the end for Q&A. Feel free to submit questions in the chat or in the Q&A, and we'll try to cover them as quickly as we can. In our last episode, we talked a lot about this National Guardsman that appeared to have leaked some classified intelligence data. Subsequently, he's been arrested for it. Actually, that happened live on the show. We had our viewers chime in and tell us that the arrest would occur even after we had started the show. So that was pretty cool. And it really seems to be highlighting this need for safeguarding and the handling of classified information. And Trevor, that's why we wanted to bring you on. As we know, there's been quite an overwhelming response, both from the community and specifically from the DoD Office of the CIO. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we were talking about this before. There's a lot's been going back and forth around this. We really don't know what happened here, as the government tends to be very hush when these situations happen until they're completely remediated. But what we can use is the actual guidance that they've released for other agencies to figure out or piece together partially what happened just by looking at what they're telling people to fix.
And what is that? We all read this memo from the DoD. I think there were two deadlines in it. One was around, was it recertifying access by yesterday?
Yeah, and May 2nd.
And then I'll have you tell our audience what that means in a second. And then CIOs have until about the end of the month to do that same thing. So what does that mean when a DoD CIO says recertify access by yesterday for someone that was trying to comply with that? What would that have meant?
Yeah. So a lot of times when we see government timelines like this, they're multi-stepped due to just the reality of working at a large agency like that. Most of the time we see policy first and then action second. So in this case, it's the get your ducks in a row. We're expecting you to validate that everyone is on need to know. Right, just a government term that basically means least privilege. And then over the next month, you're going to be expected to not just enforce it, but make it provable, right? A lot of these come with an audit, or they come with a report, or they come with some way to actually prove out that you're hitting these requirements. And what these requirements really are spelled out really straightforward in NIST 800-53, which is the bedrock government cybersecurity compliance document. And it's been around for almost a decade at this point. So really what this is doing is enforcing the basic stuff that agencies should have been doing and most likely have been missed in this situation.
Now, the specific controls, Trevor, that got outlined, they had a lot to do with least privilege, with audit logging, and then some things around monitoring. When we talk about like AC6, I know you wanted us to talk about today. You felt that was really important. Let's think about what might have happened here, right? We've got this person who's got some level, maybe too much, maybe just right amount of access to a system, and they clearly have been able to use that access to leak information. I think these are things that we've all generally accepted at this point. But why would enforcing need to know or doing an entitlement review help with that?
Yeah, so a lot of the data that was leaked was active wartime information, right? When we think about the Department of Defense's mission and what their most critical data is, like active strategy, locations of weapon caches, these are the things that you don't want the adversary to know. So these are the things that we think that they're going to have under the most lock and key. And if you're not actively involved in that wartime situation, you should be protected from seeing it, and that data should be protected from you, regardless of whether there's malicious intention or not. There was in this situation. So when they talk about need to know, when they talk about least privilege, it's should an Army National Guardsman or an Air National Guardsman in the United States have visibility into this type of communication and weapons and wartime information? And in this case, we've seen no, and we see the reason why, because it only takes one, even though there may have been 10, 15,000 people with access to this data, which would be too many in that case, the one person who slips up or the one person who has malicious intent ends up causing significant damage to the effort.
I think another debated thing, I'm actually curious to see, David, both what you think about this and our audience, is we figured out the MOS of Jack Teixeira. I hope I'm pronouncing the name right. This National Guardsman that got arrested seems to be like a cyber transport systems engineer for the Air Force. And it's debated whether or not that meant that this came with privileged access or like administrative rights. Either way, right? An admin needing to have these rights to carry out tasks and needing to potentially go unmonitored or have unrestricted access. I think that's why we're seeing the controls getting suggested around who's got privileged accounts. Do they have the right level of privilege? And are we actually monitoring when they use that access? This just undermines the importance of trust but verify, which I think is another really common government phrase we all hear.
Yeah, I think, first of all, least privilege, monitoring user access, who knew? Kind of a basic thing. I think one of the interesting things here is it shows how an organization can do just about everything right, from like the getting into the building and blocking at the endpoint and segmenting networks, even having discontinuous or disconnected islands of information. But if data still gets out, then it's kind of catastrophe, right? These kinds of attacks, like the insiders, if you don't do a good job with walling off what people can access in the first place and monitoring what they're doing, these kinds of things are really hard to combat and start and stop.
I think that's the sentiment I would echo as well. This is supposed to be like the most locked down data, short of maybe, let's say, like the Coca-Cola recipe, right? Maybe there's less people because not so many people need to have access to that at one time. What I could imagine, there are lots of soldiers and leaders on the battlefield that do need access to this intelligence, as you talked about, Trevor. Maybe more than they need access to the secret formula or the seven herbs and spices combination. But with the data being so locked down already and this still being at risk, I think this undermines the insider risk that we all face, that every organization faces, especially when you think of the motivations behind it. It's unclear that it's clout is the only motivation or internet points is the only motivation for this particular incident, but I think time will tell on that. And Trevor, I know you live in this space. You're always advising our clients on what to do here. People that are trying to do the right thing before the end of May, do you have any tips or recommendations for them on how to obviously take the DoD's advice and the memo's advice, but anything you want to go above and beyond that?
Realistically, one of the biggest problems with breaches like this is the length of staying power, right? So he was gone or compromised or however you want to say it for over a month before anybody realized what was happening. The data that persisted on those discard logs, we only know half of it, right? How many private communications did he have? How many WhatsApp communications did he have? And we can see it called out in access investigations, right? After you have a breach or when you catch a breach, you have to have a strong understanding of what happened. You have to have all of your data or all your ducks in a row so you can at least understand what the fallout was, right? We're only seeing the publicly available breach at this point. Who knows if the adversary got access to that information and who knows how much of it we don't even know, how much of it wasn't breached. So having a strong auditing understanding of who's touching what is going to be really important if this ever happens, because knowing what's been breached is sometimes more important than anything else, right? Knowing the fallout.
And I just want to echo a sentiment from Richard, one of our viewers, around using some monitoring tools to potentially identify behaviors outside the norm would also be helpful here. Now, not that we want to put this topic to rest, because we know a lot of you are really passionate about it, but we do have a couple other segments that we want to jump into. But let's make sure that we talk about good news. Every episode, we always want to cover that the good guys are doing good stuff, because there's always a lot of doom and gloom in cybersecurity, yet there's some good stuff happening. And so the first thing that we obviously want to talk about here is we've got this CryptoBot malware operation, David. So first off, welcome back. So happy to have you here. Rob was a good stand-in, but no substitute for the dad jokes and the puns that you bring to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Good to be back. Yeah, this is good news. I think we'll start out, what is CryptoBot? This is an info stealer. It was first seen or popular in 2019. It was previously distributed via phishing email in 2022. It came back via this cracked software. And I guess the group that Google is now able to disrupt was tricking users into downloading malicious versions of Google Earth Pro and probably more dangerously, Google Chrome. And so once these were installed, it's malware, steals everybody's information. Google can now disrupt and take down the domains that this group is operating from. And I guess, you know, since it's Chrome and it's Google Earth, it's definitely relevant for Google to disrupt that network as well. One thing that I thought was interesting is this cracked malware was distributed by the site 360 Installer. That's kind of the hub, and I think that other malware sites would point people to this, and it was like a pay-per-install thing, so each of the affiliates or whatever would get paid every time somebody installed this cracked malware. And I just go back through your history, your browser history, if you've ever downloaded Chrome or been redirected there. I searched through mine just to make sure I usually am pretty good about not going anywhere, but... check
this is the first time that we've seen Google disrupt a malware ring using, it's almost like trademark or copyright as the grounds, right? Like these are Google products that are being rebranded or recoded for malicious intent, or not even recoded, but just things that appear like Google products. It was something, was it called Glupteba or Glupteba? I think it was back in 2021. It was like a big botnet that they used a similar authority to do. Shout out if we got any Googlers or Mandiant folks on the line, shout out for being a part of the good news for our show today.
Yeah, it's nice to see. Nice to see the good guys get a win.
Now, there are a few vulnerabilities that we want to talk about as well. David, I think the first one that comes to mind for me is one that we actually authored for the first time in, what was it, August of 2021? It's getting the rounds again because Krebs released an article just a couple of days ago talking about abusing guest access to Salesforce. Now, you're our resident expert on Salesforce permissions. Would you mind giving our audience just like a little bit of background on like how this is possible, and then talk about like the impact of taking advantage of abusing these misconfigured communities?
Yeah, sure. And this blog, we updated it in light of the recent events here, but we did write about it a couple of years ago. Salesforce isn't just an internal CRM solution. It's far more than that. And there's a lot of external facing use cases for Salesforce, like communities, sales communities, support, help desk. People log in to a Salesforce over the internet, and actually login probably isn't the right word, because you have public facing pages that are accessible via the internet. And when you do that, you're using what's called a guest account in Salesforce. Now, the guest account can have a lot of different rights. And of course, people want to lock it down, but because Salesforce is a big app with a lot of sophistication and a lot of complexity, it's easy to get a profile or a permission set configured incorrectly for that guest user. And so what happens is that guest user gets more access than people think to more objects and more records than people think. And then this can be used, especially if you connect to it via API, to scrape a lot of information out of these Salesforce instances. So this is true for...
Go ahead, David. Yeah.
I was just going to say it's not the only SaaS app that has configuration issues like that.
And for some of our, let's say, offensive-minded security folks on the line, using something like a burp suite, you could send specially crafted packets, requests, particular web requests, to these community sites to do a little bit of enumeration, find out the different objects that are out there that might have access to the guest profile. With a little bit of creative Google searching, like the in URL Google searching, you might be able to find one of these pages where these objects are hosted and then request them via the API, because this guest user profile has access to these objects and the sensitive or private or even potentially restricted information might be finding its way into these communities and into these Salesforce objects that have the guest profile, that have access to them. So that there's a much bigger thing to think about here, which is not just, yes, this is one way that having some sort of public access gets exploited, but it also undermines, and I want to shout out like Amazon on this, right? Amazon was dealing with this with public facing S3 buckets. I'm sure everyone on our show today has heard a story about someone who, for some reason or another, flipped a bucket to public. And this begs the question for me, is it up to the manufacturers to try to stop this? To give the example for Amazon, buckets used to have a potential to be set default public and had to be flipped to private. then the default was private. Now, not only is the default private, but to set it to public, you actually have to click yes twice. You have to click yes to the config. And then when you hit save, it's like, are you sure you want to do this? And then you have to hit save again. Obviously, if you create the bucket via like API or a Terraform script, it's not going to happen that way. But if you're doing it via the Amazon console, there are a lot of barriers to you setting and configuring a bucket this way. How much of the onus is on us, the users, the community that leverages Salesforce versus Salesforce themselves to help eliminate these loopholes?
This is one of the things about the shared responsibility model. I think people are responsible for configuring the applications, and sometimes there's a little bit more responsibility than people realize. And there's some complexity there too. I think that the S3 example that you gave is great, right? And making it easier for people to configure things in the right way. But still, it's not exactly for the faint of heart. Right. There are several options, right? If you go into the S3 configuration, it's like, do you want only new stuff to be public or like old stuff? It's all stuff. It's like there are a couple different configuration options. And I think the sophistication and the amount of knowledge that people really need to have, let's just say it may be harder in the cloud, but I don't think it's really getting easier. We've invested a lot of time in the on-prem infrastructure, configuring hosts, configuring network security, learning about this. And there's just as much in the shared responsibility model. Just because you may not have to patch an OS, you may not have to worry so much about the network segmentation on a SaaS, you still got to worry about making sure that things are configured correctly and really that the data is locked down. And there are a lot of knobs and options that you have to know these days.
And I want to ask our audience this question as well. Two-part question, everybody. One, do you have Salesforce? Two, have you actually verified, if not just trust that your admins are doing the right thing, but verified that you don't have exposure via this guest profiling in your communities? The reason I bring that up is we see customers who maybe aren't monitoring their Salesforce with a Varonis yet. They'll call on us because they have an incident. Someone tells them, hey, I got some data. I don't know how it got on the web. They think it might have originated from Salesforce. And what we're often finding is that security teams aren't quite as involved in the configuration of a Salesforce because it's usually someone else that bought Salesforce and had hired the people to administer Salesforce. And so it's a little bit of a black box to security teams, or maybe they only do manual review or they're just asking their admins. I'm really curious to see if any of our audience members have actually themselves checked to see if their Salesforce has had exposures or if you're relying on either a third party or your administrators to do that.
Yeah, and there's some big bucket items that are hard to see. One of the other things that we see is the UAT environments, the sandbox environments that happen to have complete copies. You know, maybe it's like a month old, but then the access controls aren't minded in the same way there and the configurations in the same way.
I think there was another zero day, David, that you were really eager to share with everybody. This one has to deal with some, what was it called? The Cisco Prime Collaboration Deployment Server, if I remember.
Yeah, that. Or a PCD, if you're cool. But yeah, there's a zero day. This is a component that's part of their Unified Communications Management Suite. And essentially, it's a component that runs on these PCD servers. And these are typically internal servers, but there's a web UI to administrate them, and guess what? It doesn't validate input. So look for a patch next month. But in the meantime, you've got to contain these servers, and I would probably segment off that web interface to just trusted hosts, a jump box or some sort of thing. I don't know what you'd recommend there, Matt.
Yeah, I was going to say, or if you've got the ability to monitor the requests that web server is receiving, even if you're just streaming a log somewhere. What you want to look for are someone that might be attempting to execute arbitrary code for the lack of this input validation, or even do some reconnaissance. So just gather information back in the replies that might reveal sensitive information. And you got to think this Cisco device is on the internal network already. So this is a great place to potentially even mask your reconnaissance or lateral movement or privilege escalation activities, or even actions on objectives.
Yeah, it's a component that I think is probably likely to be not messed with a lot or not thought of a lot by admins because it runs the comms and it's set it and forget it. But this is a great place to hide. Speaking of which,
yeah, right, talking about hiding, yeah. Right? 3CX is getting another round. I actually want us to call this a supply chain attackception. For those of you that have ever seen the movie Inception, and you know, it's got many layers, right? The interesting nuance here is there was this trading technologies was first targeted by this North Korean attacker group. I want to say that Mandiant is deeming them, let me make sure I'm reading the name of it. It's a UNC 4736. And they targeted a company called Trading Technologies where they were able to identify supply chain vulnerabilities. vulnerability. They use that supply chain vulnerability to attack 3CX to subsequently establish another supply chain of vulnerability to attack their clients. So you've got this supply chain attackception where one attacker group has a very clear motive that they want to have these very difficult to detect, most likely zero-day vulnerabilities that then they leverage to go find more zero-day vulnerabilities. And so I think the first thing you have to take into account here is you've got a very dedicated attacker that's not just going to spend the time to like get in your network and unleash ransomware. They're after, you know, what might be your crown jewels, your code, or, you know, your manufacturing process to find a way to insert themselves in it to infect your clients. And then if you've got clients that also make things, their clients, and that's really the nuance or the special thing that happened here. Now, in terms of who they targeted, we're seeing both financial services. We're also seeing these information technology providers, because these fintech companies, they make a product, right? Trading technologies, they make a trading technology. 3CX, they make a phone and telephony collaboration system. And we're also seeing some of the command and control framework that was used by the Lazarus Group, which might indicate a connection between UNC 4736 and the Lazarus Group, or maybe they're the same people. I think Mandiant's probably out far ahead in terms of attribution here. And so we'll look to them to see some updates. But what's the practical advice here? I actually want to go back to something that Trevor talked about and some of our audience members did as well. We hear all these initiatives around zero trust, around assume that there's compromise everywhere, and how would you lock things down? I also think this undermines the importance of something, David, that you and I talk about a lot, which is protect the thing that you care about the most. So that no matter what the vectors change, these are two vectors to your data, this 3CX supply chain attack, this trading technology supply chain attack. If the thing that you're trying to protect is well hardened and well monitored, it doesn't really matter what vector the attacker used to get in. You'll know when they go after that thing. And I think if there's one takeaway, every show we have vulnerabilities to talk about. Every show we have 0 days to discuss that give attackers another vector, but the target remains the same.
And making sure that the right people have the right access as well as the right applications, right? Getting to that least privilege model and then monitoring what people are doing there. That goes back to that same guidance.
And for those of you that don't know, I imagine it was a number of years ago, David, you actually had a really popular article in USA Today or something about another UDP protocol vulnerability, you know, certainly pretty passionate about that. This SLP amplification attack, what's that? What's the implication? What's like the risk factor for our viewers?
Yeah, this is really interesting. And I enjoy learning about these denial of service attacks. I've kind of seen them over the years evolve. This one is in a protocol called the Service Location Protocol. It's a protocol I think came out in 1997. It was designed for the use on the LAN so you could advertise printers and other services. And it's UDP and TCP port 427, but the UDP part is the operative part because that's easy to spoof. And that's because it doesn't have the three-way handshake in TCP. So the TCP is much harder to spoof. So that basically means you can masquerade as sending a packet from somewhere and you'll get a response back, even if that is to somebody else, right? And so that's the crux of it. But this SLP module, in addition to being able to respond to the victim, right? So the attacker hits the SLP server, and if they used a spoofed address, then that would go back to the victim. But the SLP service itself has a vulnerability where the attacker can register multiple services on the host and therefore take with one packet, get a whole bunch of responses, and that amplifies this.
And so those responses can be bigger. So now you're starting to get to the point of this denial of service from just clogging up a bunch of pipes or connections between different hosts, right?
Exactly. And then you multiply that by multiple hosts, and now you could essentially have a wall of UDP traffic of these SLP responses that can overwhelm your pipe. So this reminds me of the Fraggle attacks that happened with UDP before that, the Smurf attacks. I love these characters, but I remember that one. It resulted in t-shirts that I think I had said no IP directed broadcast. That initial Smurf attack was a ping, right, to a broadcast address that then amplified for everybody on that network would send the ICMP ping response to the victim. And anyway, it goes way back. So these protocols can be dangerous.
In terms of proliferation, I think the scans that we saw, there were somewhere around 60,000 hosts on the internet that were advertising SLP outbound. Do we get that number right? Is that from BitSight?
I think 54,000 is what they said from BitSight. And then, so 54,000 hosts and each of them doing a 2,200 times multiple of the initial packet. That's scary. It's a big amount of traffic.
Certainly a decent amount of exposure, and primarily use network devices like printers and also
ESX
EVM
service, though.
ESX?
Yeah, that's right. So there's some stuff. VMware talked about this and warned about this as well.
And that's not even the most dangerous thing we want to talk about. Let's jump into the danger zone and talk a little bit about some nation state activity. The first thing that I want to mention around this Alloy Taurus, also associated with something that's called Pingpool. This is a Chinese nation state actor. They've got a new variant. They've got a Linux malware variant that they're using for targeted cyber attacks. But the most interesting nuance about this for me, I wanted to share with people is I often get asked a question like around attribution. Like, how do we actually know who this attacker is? And I'm always answering with, well, start with sophistication and who uses these techniques in other places. The first layer of sophistication to Pingpool is they've got TCP, ICMP, as well as HTTPS backdoor and C2 communication channels. So they have this resilient infrastructure that no matter what their initial, maybe it's Pingpool, maybe it's Sword, which is just another malware variant they're using to get that initial foothold. They've got options. If you're blocking, let's say HTTPS traffic or ICMP traffic from getting out of your environment or TCP traffic over the port that they're trying to use, or maybe you've even got some DNS layer. So Unit 42 from Palo Alto was the first to break the story about this. Obviously all the Palo stack started to get some of those blocking mechanisms. Maybe you don't have the one that blocks the ICMP traffic or the HTTPS traffic, or the threat intelligence that you have doesn't get all those signals. That's the level of resilience that a sophisticated threat actor brings to the table when they release a new variant of malware. A lot of things in government, financial services, mostly in the other side of the world from where we're sitting today, countries like Australia, Malaysia, Vietnam, the Philippines, Cambodia, Russia. And I think in addition to all the things that we would want to mention to you guys about this RAT, this remote access intrusion, is this Pingpool variant. That is the new thing to the table, or the updated attacker techniques. And this group has also been associated with the name Gallium. Many organizations are worried about espionage from Chinese state actors going after intellectual property and defense information. And if you're in that part of the world, definitely probably want to make sure that your defenses are well aware of Alloy Taurus, or Gallium as it's hence been reported, and some of the things that you can do to identify whether it's Pingpool or Sword getting dropped on your network.
Yeah, definitely upping the sophistication there.
Upping the cuteness and the sophistication at the same time. What is this charming kitten Bella Chow? What's the story here on that, David?
Apparently this APT group did some market research and Rat was not as popular as Cat. So their charming kitten just had to get the dad joke in there. So anyway, this is an Iranian-sponsored APT group, also known as something less cute, Phosphorus and APT-35. But this is an ATP group and they have malware called Bella Chow. And can you translate that for us, Matt?
Yeah, that's beautiful hello in Italian. Yeah. This would be of a beautiful woman because we had Bella. I have parlano poco d'italiano for any Italian audience members that we have.
That's some good game right there with that translation. Thank you. But anyway, this is new malware, Bitdefender for dark reading. It was discovered by Bitdefender. It's pretty sophisticated. They custom build the malware for each victim. But what I thought was pretty interesting was the command and control mechanism. The way that it would do the command and control would be through DNS. And that's not new in itself, but the way they did it through DNS is every 24 hours, they would resolve a name. And the instructions were encoded, may not be the right word, but signaled through the resulting IP address in that DNS query. So each octet would have, based on whatever the number was, would signal different instructions for the malware to do. And so it's hiding in plain sight. I think we're seeing the sophistication of this just continue to elevate. It's not really clear so far what the malware is going to be used for in each of these cases, but it seems like Charming Kitten is trying to charm its way into a lot of different organizations, and to be determined later what they're going to use it for.
What a fluffy way to articulate that. I think that when we talk about this, we've talked about DNS tunneling and DNS command and control before, where attackers will use the host name to do the command and control part. So it'll be maliciousdomain.command.command.com. But what you're saying, that the change here is that they're actually translating it to the actual IP address itself, in the reply that is then subsequently issuing commands. So a flip-flop of the DNS command and control that we've seen in the past. And initial ASX vectors for Charming Kitten seem to be all over the place. We saw things like the Microsoft Exchange 0 days, the Manage Engine 0 days. So really any means that they need in order to get in.
Yeah, this seems to be like whatever the vulnerability is, however we can get in, get the dropper in, and then we'll go from there.
Anything interesting coming in the chat that we want to cover? I did want to echo one comment, though, from Diane, if that's okay with you, David. It's talking about this kind of gap in security knowledge where not everyone is a Salesforce architect and understands if they click one thing here, what the downstream impact is going to be over here. And just talking about the need for documentation and steps and controls and who can set those configurations. So you've got the right people with the right level of knowledge setting the config, and then the right people with the right training and knowledge confirming the config. I want to say something about that, though. When you start to think about that problem at scale in cloud, you start to get overwhelmed really quickly. Not everyone has the cyber force, the size of DoD or our largest banks with hundreds or even potentially thousands of people in cyber. A lot of people are just skating by with a couple of people. And so when you think about that, you start to see the need for automation or start to see the need to partner with third parties to be able to do all of that cloud or security posture monitoring that you might want to.
I think this reminds me of a conversation that I've had with a few folks is just choosing what you want to invest time learning. A lot of the configurations change quite a bit. And, you know, it's, gosh, do I really want to invest the time in memorizing or really learning a whole suite of configurations that's going to be different next month? I remember back in the mid 90s, it was like, do I learn NetBuoys or IPX, SPX or IP? And thankfully, I chose wisely on that one. But you want to make sure you target your effort that's going to pay off.
Yeah, and potentially use like a risk-based approach, right? Spend your time on the things where the most risk exists. The last question came in from Diane. Thank you, by the way, Diane. Listening to how DNS is being utilized in a similar way to how covert channels and hardware were utilized in multi-level security systems, are those old methodologies relevant or becoming more relevant today?
It's really interesting. I feel like the fundamentals, you can't escape them. And these things that we talked about today with some of the, you know, SLP and the DNS, without a fundamental understanding on how some of these bedrock things work, it's hard to follow along with some of the newer attacks, certainly. I'm not sure if I'm answering the questions, but I feel like they're more relevant. I mean, we haven't fully transitioned to IPv6 yet, and we've been talking about that for over 20 years.
I would say that, if anything, same methods, more creative, you know, ways to implement. And people are finding more ways to use this age-old protocol that I don't think is going anywhere, which is DNS. Trevor, I got one for you that came in from Andrew. I read that the DoD leaker was able to browse a database. Can you talk to how you can make least privilege and audit people for sponsoring that database? Like, it seems like a big miss that someone was able to have access to a database. Now, let's leave whether or not that happened or not for the OIG report. Let's just speak to it generally, right? What could be done to make least privilege and make something like that auditable?
Yeah, so a lot of it is just going to be around collecting the right data and collecting it from all the data sources. But on the other hand, when it comes to privileged accounts, they have to have extra scrutiny applied to them, right? We've seen a lot of tools that password vault administrative accounts have a checkout system so that if you do have accounts that have this elevated privilege and they are designed for an explicit purpose, right? And this goes for service accounts as well. When they're in use, we know when they're in use. And when they're not in use, they're not just floating in the ether for somebody to grab or to use. Whether or not this person's activity was or their access was legitimate or illegitimate, the fact that they could come and go as they pleased with no oversight or no behavioral analytics to say this user's ticking up in risk or ticking down in risk really presents a huge oversight.
But we'll take this one last question here from Ryan. I'm going to point this one to you, David. We've got Salesforce, but security wasn't as involved in planning or rollout. We feel pretty blind to the Salesforce environment. What are our first steps? What should we do to learn more and investigate, and what guardrails should we provide? Now, before you answer, I'm going to do a shameless plug here. If you really don't know where to start, other than David's advice, because he's a Salesforce guru, we do offer free risk assessments. It's going to be a start, right? You're going to get an idea of what some of the misconfigurations that might exist or some of the exposure that you might have in Salesforce. And there is no obligation to move forward from that. So if you want us to take a look at your Salesforce, you can either follow up or you can have one of our moderators follow up with you. But David, any other practical advice there?
Yeah, there are a couple of native tools in Salesforce, but the first place I check is what's called your org-wide sharing defaults. What we're seeing there is a lot of the record types are overly accessible by default, and end users don't realize who's got access to which resources or which records in Salesforce, and they'll upload sensitive attachments or they'll put sensitive data in the notes, not realizing they're exposing it to everybody in the company. And the other thing is what I mentioned at the outset is check, okay, how many Salesforce environments do we actually have? And how many of them have external developer access because we need somebody's help to do what we're doing? And how many have complete copies of Salesforce? And as Matt said, there's tons of configuration settings. There's tons to check with the permissions. And if you want to get a little help with that, it's an easy process for us to do that.
Yeah, I think with that, first of all, Trevor, thanks so much for joining us today. It was great to have an expert on the public sector, especially on the Department of Defense, and especially, and again, how hot and relevant that topic is. Welcome back, David. And thank you to our audience. This show is made possible because of you. We really appreciate your viewership and your feedback and your engagement. And we look forward to seeing you in our next episode.
Thanks so much, everybody.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks, Trevor.